name is Professor Margaret Abernethy, and I'm Dean of the Faculty of Business and Economics and also Professor of Accounting. So it is my very great pleasure to welcome you all here tonight. Now, this is the 72nd annual CPA Australia University of Melbourne Research Lecture. It is the oldest lecture, public lecture, that the university has. Now, in forums such as this, the University of Melbourne always recognises the traditional owners of the Kulin Nation in an effort to ensure reconciliation among all Australians. So I'd like to make that acknowledgement. So there are a few people that I'd like to make a special welcome to. President of the Victorian Division of CPA Australia, Joanne Rumble, welcome, as well as General Manager of the Victorian Division, John Aloney, and members of CPA. I believe you're here for the CPA Congress down at the Convention Centre. I was there at lunchtime, and I must say it was certainly well supported and very well organised. I'd also like to welcome my academic colleagues, both here and in other universities in Victoria. And if you have come from out of Victoria, I welcome you. And of course, the members of the university community and the general public, and all members of the profession. Thank you for helping to make this the long-standing tradition that we hold very dear in the faculty. Through your attendance at tonight's lecture and also for prior lectures. Tonight's lecture will be given by Annette Kimmett of Ernst & Young, and I'm delighted she is able to deliver the lecture. This lecture series is endowed by CPA Australia, and the lecture was established for the purpose of promoting and stimulating research and encouraging original contribution in accounting. Before I conclude, I would also like to note that this public lecture is being filmed for university purposes, and that any questions that you may ask at the conclusion of the lecture will be recorded, and we will allow time for questions. So Annette, thank you very much for agreeing to give this lecture, and I'm now going to call on Professor John Lyon, who is the head of the Department of Accounting, to introduce you. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Maggie. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Annette Kimmett. Annette has a highly impressive CV. We're very privileged that she's been able to make some time here to join us this evening. Department of Accounting is particularly fortunate to have a continuing association with Annette as both an honorary fellow and as a past executive in residence, and a person who is actively involved in our Centre of Accounting and Industry Partnerships. Annette is a managing partner of Ernst & Young's Melbourne office, leading a team of more than 110 partners and 1,500 staff. She is responsible for the firm's involvement in the broader Melbourne community and its go-to-market and client service strategies. Since joining Ernst & Young, and its primary focus has been assisting clients in navigating and implementing international financial reporting standards. This has resulted in her providing advice on many high-profile and complex transactions within organisations, such as at Bendigo Bank, the Adelaide Bank, Suncorp Metway, Macquarie Bank, Telstra, Orica, Foster's, and many other major business concerns. Annette has also developed significant experience in the public sector and public sector reporting under Australian international standards, providing advice to numerous government departments and agencies. This has included working with the Department of Defence on its transition to Australian international financial reporting standards. And prior to joining Ernst & Young in early 2005, Annette was Senior Project Director with the IASB, leading many of the board's highest profile projects. She has acted as the board's liaison with groups such as the European Financial Reporting Advisory Group, the Committee of European Securities Regulators, the US Securities and Exchange Commission, the International Organisation of Securities Commissions, and of course the Australian Accounting Standards Board. During her 4 years at the IASB, Annette worked extensively with major corporations in Australia, France, Germany, Japan, South Africa, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom on the practical issues arising from the implementation of international financial reporting standards. She has also led regular roundtable seminars with major corporations, audit firms, accounting standard setters and regulators in the US and Canada on the practical issues faced by North American corporations with their implementation of US standards. Needless to say, she's highly regarded globally for her deep technical skills and her commercial understanding of clients' issues. Annette is a fellow and past Victorian chairman of the Institute of Chartered Accountants in Australia. She sits on the board of the United Nations Principles for Social Investments, which is part of the UN Secretariat working to facilitate global efforts and reporting on the impact of social investment. She is also on the Committee for Melbourne and on the Audit Committee of the Grattan Institute. Annette is the author of many Australian and international exposure drafts, accounting standards, and articles on financial accounting. She speaks regularly at forums on diverse range of issues, including leading and managing change, entrepreneurship and innovation, and women's leadership. So without further delay, then I would ask you to please welcome Annette Kimmett to the lectern to present the 72nd Annual CPA Lecture. Welcome.
Good evening, everyone. I'll start with an apology. I've got a slight cough, so if I cough through the session, I'm very sorry. I'll try and keep it to a minimum. So as the slide says, I'm going to talk tonight about the sustainability of the audit profession and try and bring to you a bit of a practitioner's perspective. The early part of the 21st century, so the early part of this century, I think has seen quite an explosion in the scale and also the pace of regulatory change. We've seen economic and capital market conditions that have really quite significantly increased the risk of corporate failure. And what I've tried to do with tonight's presentation is really explore the impact that those and other factors have had on Australia's major professional services firms, particularly the profitability and sustainability of our audit practices. So the presentation is really structured in three parts. In the first part, I wanted to just try and provide a bit of a context, and so an overview of the environmental landscape that's confronted auditors over the past few years, and explore a little bit on how those changes in the landscape have really impacted the role of the auditor, the cost of conducting audits, and the risk and complexity changes in financial statement audits. So part one's a bit of an overview and contextualisation. Part two, in part two of the presentation, I'm going to spend a bit of time trying to analyse how those changes have really impacted the setting of audit fees over the past few years, and also how the major firms have responded to the challenge of setting audit fees as we try to pursue sustainable growth in our practices. And then finally, I'd like to wrap up by just positing a few questions and perhaps some ideas for how the audit profession might evolve itself for a sustainable future. I do want to flag up front, though, that whilst we, in developing this presentation and the research paper that I understand is going to be available to you after this lecture, while in developing that, we have drawn on some fairly rudimentary research in support of some of the things that we're saying. The paper has been developed and written from a practitioner's perspective. So it draws very heavily from my own experiences as the managing partner of our audit practice in Melbourne from 2007 to 2009, so right through the peak of the global financial crisis storm, and also in managing our broader Melbourne office, our broader practice from 2009 to today. So it's actually my hope that some of the ideas that I've tried to set out, that I will try to set out out tonight and that are set out in the paper provide a bit of impetus for far more in-depth academic research in support of hopefully a sustainable future for the audit profession. So I thought I'd better give you that disclaimer up front. So let me start with this constantly changing landscape. As I said at the start, the early years of this century saw quite an explosion in the scale and the pace of regulatory, economic, capital market and also other changes that have impacted us as auditors and also the complexity of conducting financial statement audits. So I thought I might run you through a bit of a laundry list of what some of those changes are. Just and I haven't, it's not an all-encompassing laundry list, but I think it gives you a good sense of the issues we've been trying to grapple with over the past few years. So we had the dot-com bubble bursting and a whole range of major corporate collapses starting in 2001 to 2002. It included collapses like Enron, WorldCom, Arthur Andersen, and here in Australia we had our own collapses with HIH, Ansett, Pasminco and OneTel. We've seen very far-reaching reverberations and uncertainties caused by the events of September 11. We then had the introduction of Sarbanes-Oxley in 2002, and we also had the continued expansion through that time by ASIC of its financial reporting surveillance program. In 2004-05, we had the introduction of CLERP 9, which for us resulted in new, far more detailed and I think far more stringent independence and rotation requirements, and also established the audit quality inspection activities by ASIC. That was then supplemented by more increases in audit firm scrutiny as a result of audit inspections by the PCAOB. We then had more corporate collapses in Australia during 2004 to 2006. We had Sons of Gwalia and West Point, just to name a few. And then in 2005, the transition to IFRS, which I think represented the most significant change to financial reporting in Australia's history in terms of both the extent and the complexity of the big bang change that needed to be implemented. We then saw auditing standards become legally enforceable in 2006. They were then further clarified last year in 2010. We had the global financial crisis kick off in 2008 with a credit crunch that led to another avalanche of corporate collapses and also near collapses, but this time on a scale that we hadn't seen since the years preceding World War II. The collapses included organisations like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns in the United States. Back home, we had Babcock and Brown, ABC Learning Centres and ALCO. We had the near collapse in the US of organisations like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, and certainly closer to home, Centro, which is one that's very close to our hearts at Ernst & Young. Emanating from the wake of that global financial crisis, we have a present-day debt crisis that's now plaguing the major global economies such as the United States and also the European Union. We've also, back home, seen fairly significant impacts on corporate Australia from very large-scale natural disasters, such as the 2009 Black Saturday bushfires here in Victoria, and then last year the Queensland cyclones, the Queensland floods, and the 2010 Victorian floods. All of those, again, massive impacts on corporate Australia. We've also seen, over and above all of this, fairly continuous and wholesale changes being made since 2005 to the entire suite of IFRS and a whole raft of related interpretations. And I think the extent and complexity of those changes really only rivals the initial adoption of IFRS in 2005. So I get tired just reading that. We needed to implement all of that. So those changes, from our perspective, have quite significantly increased, I guess, the risk and the complexity of undertaking financial statement audits. I think they've also, all of those changes also highlight the importance of audit quality to market confidence. And I think that as the contracted, what I call the contracted regulators of financial reporting, as auditors we have inevitably had to increase the amount of audit effort in response to all of these higher risks. So let me just talk a little bit about these increased risks and complexity. So I think the fact that there is increased risk and complexity certainly arising from the onset of the GFC is pretty strongly evident in the significant increases we've seen in the number of corporate insolvencies in this country in recent years. You can see 2006-07 year We had around 7,500 jumping in 2008-09, which was the eye of the storm for the GFC, to about 10,000 and really settling still at around that 10,000, 9,800 mark in the most recent years. We've also seen fairly significant increases in the levels of qualified and modified audit opinions issued in Australia, and those qualifications and modifications are all predominantly being driven by significant uncertainties related to going concern. So, for example, the level of qualified and modified audit opinions has gone up from 13.7% in 2007 to more than 23% in 2009. So as a result of all of this, the major firms have needed to invest pretty heavily nationally and globally to make sure that our resources, our policies, our operational practices all keep pace with these regulatory and economic and other changes to make sure that we keep delivering high quality audits. And again, by way of example, the changes to auditing standard and audit inspection arrangements have involved for us fairly significant increases in the cost of doing an audit. And those costs relate to things like ensuring that the application of our global audit methodology and our methodology and our tools and all of our templates will still result in compliance with legally enforced and also clarified auditing standards without disrupting the ability of those methodologies and tools to make sure we get compliance with other jurisdictions' auditing standards as well. It's meant for us additional dedicated personnel for ongoing ASIC and PCAOB liaison. It's also meant fairly significant increases in our senior auditor time for liaising also with ASIC and the PCAOB during the inspections themselves. We've had to increase the focus on the levels of documentation and the review needed to make sure that our auditors are able to support and, as appropriate, defend the extent of work that they've undertaken in reaching their audit opinions. And that's just to name a few of the areas that we've had to really ramp up our efforts. All of these increased costs that have been brought about by changes to the auditing standards and the audit inspection regime are really difficult to quantify separate from the other cost increases that we've experienced because of all of those other changing factors, such as the introduction of IFRS. But the view of the major firms is absolutely that these changes, and in particular the documentation requirements, have for us resulted in far more time and effort having to be spent on matters that we think are unrelated to what I'd call the substantive issues of the audit, and we've had to do that without any impact on the quality of audit. And I think these views that are held quite widely across the audit profession are in fact supported by the 2009 ANU study. The title of the study was The Future of Auditing, Keeping Capital Markets Efficient. And that study collated the views of regulators, so not just the auditors, but the regulators, the standard setters, professional bodies, the major firms, and also both the users and the purchasers, so the investors and the corporates, so the users and purchasers of auditing services. And the report concludes quite conclusively that there is no evidence that the legal backing of standards has in fact enhanced the credibility of financial statements, the quality of auditing, or its role in the capital market, or even reduced the likelihood of unanticipated corporate collapse. The report goes on to conclude that the changes have, however, given rise to considerable cost, both financial and non-financial. The changes to oversight, including but not limited to regulatory inspections, have also had costs and have profoundly changed, I think, the structure of the work, which this report concludes is going to have considerable continuing consequences for audit firms and their staff. So that's really the context within which we've been operating. I guess what I would say, though, is that the success throughout all of this, the success of certainly the major firms as the contracted regulators of financial reporting right through this period of very significant change has been absolutely reaffirmed by ASIC and by the Australian Treasury. ASIC's public report arising from its 2010 inspection of audit firm quality found that Australia's audit regime was robust and compared well internationally, and similarly the Australian Treasury stated in its 2010 report on audit quality that Australia's financial reporting system and audit regulation is both robust and stable. So I think that if you think about the global financial crisis as a bit of a stress test of audit, I think that stress test demonstrated we were up to it and it didn't result in structural failure of the audit profession. So that's a bit of context and background. In terms of how all of that has played out on our firms, on audit fees, on how we manage our firms, and how we've responded to all of these challenges in the pursuit of sustainable growth, let me just flag up front, we are commercial enterprises and we are involved in the pursuit of sustainable growth. So this is a really important issue for us. But as I said, the increasing risks, complexity and costs of undertaking financial statement audits, with all of those increasing risks and costs, I guess one might not unreasonably hypothesise that we ought to have seen some increases in audit fees over that time, particularly in the period after 2008 and the onset of the global financial crisis. But that absolutely hasn't been the case. So let me just share with you this slide. And can I just flag that that this graph, and there are a series of other graphs included in the paper that you'll get at the end, presents nominal audit fee data, meaning that audit fees in real terms have actually declined between 2008 and 2010 at increased rates to the rates that are depicted on that slide. But that slide really sets out audit fees for the ASX 200 companies. And a few key points, I think, that are worth noting. Firstly, total nominal audit fees for the ASX 200 fell in 2010 by 12%. And while total nominal fees for the ASX 200 grew by 5%, only 5%, for the 4 years, 2007 to 2010, that's not 5% year on year, that's 5% in total. They actually fell by 11% from their peak in 2008. So that's the 2008 to 2010 period. More troubling, I guess, is that the ASX top 50, which actually accounts for about 70% of total audit fees in the ASX 200, led the fall in fees by declining 3% in 2009, so off the back of the GFC, and then a further 12% in 2010. The rest of the ASX 200 grew a little bit in 2009 before declining quite significantly in 2010. The other key point to note through this period is that the period 2008 to 2009 and the onset of the GFC saw an extraordinary increase in the level of risk associated with undertaking financial statement audits, and we responded to the higher risks by dramatically increasing audit effort. And I was the managing partner of our audit practice at Ernst & Young during this time, and for us this increased effort, just by way of example, included increasing our focus on client risk assessments and creating what we called close monitoring panels to oversee the work of every audit team on each client whose risk rating fell above a predetermined threshold. And I can tell you with absolute certainty that whole year I spent pretty much all of my time in close monitoring panel meetings. As we set out sort of earlier on in the slide deck, the number of modified and qualified audit opinions increased from 13.7% in 2007 to 22% in 2008, and then roughly 23% in 2009. So while total audit fees, according to that slide, increased from 2007 to 2008 and roughly held in 2009, the level of fees absolutely failed to fully compensate our firms for our increased audit effort. And for Ernst & Young, and I know for my counterpart firms, this translated into material reductions in our audit practice realisation rates. And again, the 2009 ANU study reached a similar conclusion independent of the audit firms, and it concluded quite categorically that the remuneration and rewards for members of the auditing profession have been seen to decline in relative terms, while the risks and the level of scrutiny and potential penalties have increased. So that's where we stand. The theme of declining audit fees hasn't gone away. It's kicked on and continued on in 2011. You might have seen an article in the Australian Financial Review in August of this year, which reported that the largest companies have shaved more than $12 million, another $12 million off their audit bill in the past year, and that half of the top 20 listed companies that have reported in the past 12 months have actually paid significantly less fees than they did the previous year for their audits. IBIS World has also reported back in May in its report on the accounting services industry that revenue from core services like auditing and financial reporting is expected to be flat, with clients absolutely unwilling to absorb fee increases. So I guess this poses a question for us as audit firms, which is why are these increased risk complexities and costs of audit failing to translate into economic outcomes? Thank you very much. Into economic outcomes for the audit firms. And again, I think this study, the ANU study, again, provides a little bit of insight into why this might be the case. The study found, it asked some questions, and it asked a question about whether financial statement audits are of value. And the responses to that question were quite interesting. Unsurprisingly, the suppliers of audit services, like the audit firms, believe quite strongly that auditing does provide substantial benefit to shareholders, to boards, and to the community in general, with that benefit extending, obviously, onto capital markets and the quality of information that's being used in that market. So that's not surprising. However, the purchasers of our services typically regarded auditing as a compliance good, meaning a good that's simply required by regulatory authorities and not something that itself is inherently valued. And when you look at the subgroups of purchasers, what you find is chief executive officers and the chief financial officers of this country's major corporates as a subgroup of purchasers particularly denigrated the value of financial statement audits. And I guess markets pretty much have acted efficiently and have priced services according to the value that buyers see exhibited by the service, and services that are regarded as compliance goods are invariably subject to price minimisation, and it appears to have been the case for the audit market in recent years. So I guess, again, that's all context, and what I want to spend the rest of the time talking about is how the firms have responded to this audit market increasingly under pressure, again, in pursuing sustainable growth for our firms. And the responses really came, you can think about them at two organisational levels. The first is at the level of the audit practice, so that's at one level. The second level is a higher up level, it's the whole of firm, whole of organisational level. In terms of at the audit practice level, the major firms have pretty much responded to these pressures by focusing on two things. Firstly, on the top line, and that is the pursuit of greater market share, so trying to steal market share from your competitors. And then the second area of focus has been on improving the productivity of our practices. The pressure, in terms of the greater market share, the pressure from clients to share in their pain. We heard that expression a lot. We need you to share our pain through the GFC and therefore reduce fees, particularly through that GFC period, inevitably saw the major firms begin to more aggressively compete for audit market share on price. Although, you know, the benefit of hindsight, that really only served to further fuel the declining audit fees. And even though that was the case at the time, we all thought that was tolerable on the basis that we thought pricing would ultimately rebound. But that was perhaps not well understood by us at the time was the extent to which purchasers of the audit services, particularly, as I said, the CEOs and CFOs, regarded audit as a compliance good. And what that's meant is the rebound in prices that we expected to see has instead emerged as just lower normalised realisation rates for our audit practices. So consequently, and quite predictably again, we focused a lot of efforts on and continue to focus a lot of efforts on improving the productivity of our practices. So I wanted to walk you through some examples that are particular to Ernst & Young, but as I said earlier, it's Ernst & Young experience, but I think it's quite reflective of the focus that's been placed on running practices by the other major firms as well. And our efforts around productivity have focused on, I guess, three major themes. The first theme is around eliminating wasteful and non-value-adding work in the way that we go about doing our audits. The second theme has been around being more ambitious and more effective in the way that we develop and deploy technological innovations. And then finally, we've had a very strong focus on being far more innovative in the way that we utilise our organisation's human capital. So in terms of eliminating wasteful and the non-value-adding work in the way we conduct our audits, we actually set about to create programs to quite proactively improve both the quality and effectiveness of audit engagements, but with corresponding outcomes for the efficiency of those audits. And in 2007, we designed, at EY, we designed and piloted and then implemented what we called our Audit Effectiveness and Efficiency Coaching Program, and we rolled that out right across the assurance practice. The program continues on today, to the present day, but it basically involves a continuous cycle of team-based coaching and techniques that provide experiential or on-the-job learning to facilitate, I guess, continuous improvements in both audit effectiveness and efficiency. So basically the program involves a small team of coaches performing a desktop assessment of an audit engagement and all the files, and they do that to try to identify potential effectiveness and efficiency improvements related to a range of things, related to applying our global audit methodology, related to audit planning, related to the way we utilise resources on the engagements, the way we involve other specialists during the audit, particularly IT specialists, and there's a fairly long laundry list of things that we look at. We then have that team work with the engagement team to develop actions for improving the efficiency and effectiveness of the audit. So they're co-developed, and the action plans are really focused on optimising our audit plans, the team structure, and our audit execution. That program has proven very successful over a sustained period in driving quite continuous improvement in both the effectiveness and the efficiency of our audits, and in sort of identifying and eliminating wasteful and non-value-adding audit work in the conduct of those audits. I think what we've learnt through that program was that we had a serious case of over-auditing in a lot of our engagements. On the second front of developing and deploying technological innovation, our firm, and I know that some of the academics at University of Melbourne have invested quite heavily in reviewing and doing research on our technology, but we've invested quite heavily in tools and technology to drive greater effectiveness and efficiencies in the way our teams execute our global audit methodology. And that included for us becoming the first of the major firms, and still the only major firm, to enable our audit methodology using a real-time web-based technology platform that we call GAMX. So GAM is Global Audit Methodology, but the platform's called GAMX. And over recent years, we've migrated about 60,000 of our audit staff around the world in 120 countries onto that platform. And the deployment of GAMX was very much intended to deliver, and actually has delivered, productivity, a range of productivity improvements. And I'll give you just some of the examples of how that technology's driven improvements. It's allowed us to far more effectively and efficiently empower and enable a consistent global application of our audit methodology, and in doing that, we've been able to make sure that the application of that methodology guarantees compliance, certainly in our country, with the legally enforced and clarified auditing standards. We've integrated into the technology a lot of guidance on applying the firm's audit methodology, plus a whole raft of diagnostics that operate as monitoring controls, and they're intended to help us reduce errors related to audit documentation and also errors in the way that our teams apply our methodology. But I think the most powerful thing about this technology is that it enables concurrent real-time access to work papers for all audit team members. Doesn't matter where they're sitting in the world, and it therefore allows us to be far more efficient and effective in driving these global audits, and it allows us to be far more efficient and effective in real-time reviewing and resolution of audit issues. So this enhanced communication environment means that local audit teams or head office audit teams have real-time oversight of the progress of global audits, which has just driven such incredible efficiencies through our audit engagements. It's also allowed us to simplify a whole lot of the administrative tasks and automate those administrative tasks, which is allowing our teams to put much more focus on understanding important audit issues rather than dealing with the administrative tasks. So our firm has benefited enormously from a productivity perspective with the implementation of GAMEX, but we've also, together with all of the other major firms, have been able to drive fairly significant productivity improvements by incorporating other things into our audit engagements, things like data and process analytics and continuous controls monitoring. And that's a space that all of the major firms are playing in and that is enabling things like very low cost and easy extraction of very large volumes of data from our client systems and providing us with, I guess, a look back capacity for reviewing total populations that you don't have in a manual environment, particularly when you're testing controls. So that's technology. On the use of human capital, being more innovative in the way we've used human capital, I guess the globalisation of firms like mine and our focus on making sure we're able to deliver absolute consistency in the way we develop and qualify our staff, regardless of where they're located, means that we all now are sitting on very significant global footprints of consistently high-quality talent pools. And they're sitting in regions ranging from developed to emerging economies. So in response to an audit market that's increasingly under fee pressure, a lot of the major firms, not all, but most, have embarked on fairly ambitious campaigns to reduce our overall cost rates of performing audits by more aggressively, I guess, leveraging our global talent pools, particularly those talent pools that are sitting in lower cost or in emerging regions. That doesn't mean audit work is being outsourced to low-cost service providers. What it does mean is that we are leveraging lower cost rates in certain regions by having our staff, Ernst & Young, trained and developed staff in those lower cost regions executing audit tasks that are sourced from developed nations. And I'll give you a bit more detail on how we're doing that. But given our my firms and all of the firms focus on ensuring absolute global consistency in the way we develop our talent pools and in the way that those talent pools apply our global audit methodology, we're actually able to offshore audit tasks, for example, from Australia to Bangalore and to the Philippines without in any way compromising the quality of audits. So just to give you a sense of the scale of what's happening, the Australian arm of EY, we began leveraging the firm's global talent hubs during 2009-10, so off the back of the global financial crisis as fees were coming off. In that year, we offshored about 8,000 hours. It was a bit of an experiment year, and we saved roughly about $650,000. So it was just a pilot. We upped that amount in the 2010-11 year to 29,000 hours that we offshored, and we saved just short of $2.5 million. And our target for this year, for the 2011-12 year, is for the Australian practice, is to offshore 60,000 hours, and we estimate that that's going to drive about $5 million in cost savings for the Australian practice. The nature of the work that's being offshored ranges from things like audit preparation and completion work, so things like preparing lead sheets, agreeing opening balances to prior year, agreeing information to trial balances and other supporting documents. It includes things like testing of controls and substantive procedures, so things like cash and bank reconciliations, debtor and other confirmations. They're also taking care of audit support procedures for us. So it's things like project management, the resource coordination of the teams around the world, financial analyses of our engagements, and managing our engagement independence confirmations. But over and above driving cost savings, this offshoring model is allowing certainly the Australian arm of our firm to better engage our onshore staff by freeing up those staff to focus on more interesting, the more interesting and complex audit issues and what I'd call the more value-adding work. And they tell us, our staff are telling us, that this is providing them with a better learning and development environment, and it's actually having really great flow-on effects to our staff retention rates. And it's also, this offshoring model is also allowing us here in Australia to extend our recruitment pool well beyond the local market. So, for example, Ernst & Young staff in Bangalore and the Philippines, which are the two talent hubs that we're using here in Australia, are being exposed to Australian audits and auditing standards. And what that's doing is allowing us to identify some fairly high-performing talent and to target them for potential transfer or secondment back here into Australia. So that's what's happening at the practice level. Let me just go back one slide. I did say that we were focusing on two levels, both the audit practice and the firm-wide level. At the level of the whole firm, the response has been one of diversification, diversification away from audit. And I'll just run through a couple of examples of how that's happening. IBIS World again reported back in May of this year in its accounting services industry report that a significant factor in the revenue growth of the larger firms over the past few years was the large variety of services they offered. The big four and mid-tier firms developed new areas of business not directly related to traditional accounting services. Each of the major firms has been particularly focused on building, or indeed rebuilding, their advisory and consulting arms, with particular emphasis on organisational performance improvement capability. So that's all of that has seen waves of acquisitions happening in the marketplace. For example, Deloitte's acquisition of Access Economics, their acquisition of Saha International and Agrion, and the acquisition by PwC globally of the PRTM Group. And these advisory and consulting arms of our practices have delivered significant growth to each of the firms in recent years. Just by give you some an idea of the numbers, PwC's 2010-11 growth rate as a firm was 14.7%, and it was largely driven by demand for its consulting and advisory services. The revenue from its advisory service line grew 25%, so 25% or 25.3% growth for the 12 months to 30 June this year, compared to only 2% growth in its traditional audit practice. So that's quite a stark difference. PwC's chief executive, Mark Johnson, has gone on the record saying that he believes assurance and tax would be much smaller parts of his firm in 5 years' time. KPMG's advisory services is already sitting at 44% of its overall revenue for the 2010-11 year, so it makes up the vast majority of its firm. And the expectation is that by the end of 2011-12, its advisory services would account for more than half of all of KPMG's revenues. And certainly for us at Ernst & Young, our 2010-11 growth rate was 14.8%, and as was the case with our competitors, it was likewise driven largely by the demand for our advisory services. And revenue for our advisory service line grew 29% for the 12 months to 30 June 2011. And we are also expecting and ramping up our capability to reflect this, and that is that our advisory services will, in the very near term, account for more than half of all of Ernst & Young's Australian revenues. So that's how the firms have responded. Let me just jump forward a little bit now and try to bring this, I guess, around to the question of a sustainable future for the audit profession, and just to maybe recap what I've tried to set out in these first few sections, and that is that the early years of this century have seen an absolute explosion in change, in regulatory, economic, capital market and other change. It's all had an impact on auditors and on the complexity of financial statement audits. The changes have significantly increased both the risk and the cost of doing audits, but it's failed to translate into economic outcomes for us as auditors. The markets have acted efficiently and have priced the services downward to reflect their view of audit as a compliance good. The major firms have responded to this increasing pressure by focusing on improving our market share at the audit practice level, improving our productivity, but at the whole of firm level, it's a story of diversification away from audit and as our main game. So what that means is that the audit practices are becoming of what I guess increasingly diminishing importance to the longer term sustainable growth of the major firms and to the brand and reputation of the major firms out in the marketplace. The other thing that I just wanted to touch on before I perhaps throw out some ideas for how we might continue to grow the audit profession, I wanted to touch on recent developments with the European Commission and its green paper on audit policy lessons from the crisis. It appears that the near final drafts of the regulations and of the draft legislative proposals have been leaked, and the media has gotten hold of them, and they're now in the public domain. But the draft regulation in particular absolutely fails to reflect the majority of stakeholder input that the EU gathered, and in our view would in their totality completely undermine the ability of all of the major firms to continue delivering high quality audits on which the market can rely. And some of the more extreme measures anticipated, I did want to share these with you. Firstly, is a complete ban on audit firms in the EU providing non-audit services to audit clients who are labelled as public interest entities. But more alarmingly is the anticipation of creating audit-only firms. And they're going to do that by prohibiting large firms who have a large share of the audit market from providing any non-audit services to any organisation, irrespective of whether or not that organisation is an audit client. So they're fairly drastic measures, and as I said, the view of the major firms is that this is going to completely undermine our ability to deliver quality audits. So in light of all of that, and also given, I guess, the diminishing importance the audit practices are now playing as a source of sustainable growth in the major firms, it leads to the question, how do we evolve ourselves as a profession for a sustainable future? I think it's pretty clear that the future of financial statement auditing has got to be about making sure that the market starts to see the characteristics that it brings and starts to choose to value those characteristics, because the alternative is just this continuation of the compliance good philosophy and the continuous driving down of costs and fees as a consequence. And I'm not so sure that there's much more productivity gains to be had. So I think it's quite absolutely imperative for the profession to be collaborating with regulators, standard setters, the suppliers of audit services, the purchasers of audit services, the users of audit services, and importantly, the academic community in all of this. But I think the audit profession will forego an enormous opportunity if it regards its future as inextricably linked only to financial statement auditing. I think the traditional financial reporting model was developed for an industrial world, and although it does continue to play quite an important role related to stewardship of financial resources, it does nonetheless focus on a fairly narrow account of historical financial performance, and the world has changed. So globalisation and I think the resulting interdependencies that we see in economies, in supply chains, I think advances in technology, the rapid population growth we've seen and increasing global consumption are all having dramatic impacts, significant impacts on the quality, the availability and the price of resources. Resources including not just economic resources, but water, food and energy. And I think the need for a much broader information set that can cope with all of this is pretty much demonstrated by the very small percentage of market value that's now explained by financial and physical assets. And some work done by the International Integrated Reporting Council would suggest that the explanation of market value provided by physical and financial assets is down to 19% in 2009, as compared to explaining 83% of value back in 1975. That balance, they suggest, represents intangible factors. Some of those intangible factors are explained in financial statements, but most of them are not. And so what's becoming pretty clear is the sort of information that's needed to assess past, current and future performance is much wider than what is currently the case in our existing financial reporting model. So as a result, the view of the profession, the view of the major firms is that external reporting, and I said external, not financial, external reporting is due for a major wave of reforms, and it's starting with the International Integrated Reporting Council, the IIRC, who is developing an integrated reporting framework that is intended to guide the development of an external reporting framework over the coming decades. The IIRC is made up of an incredible international cross-section of leaders from corporate sector, from the investment sector, accounting, regulatory, academic, civil society, and also the standard-setting sectors. It has already issued a discussion paper. The comments close in December of this year, and they are absolutely intending to issue an exposure draft of the proposed integrated financial integrated reporting framework next year. The global CEOs of all of the major firms are members of the IIRC and are endorsing the approach that it's taken. So according to the IIRC, this integrated reporting, what they're trying to do with it is bring together all the material information about an organisation's strategy, its governance, its performance, and also its prospects, but trying to do that in a way that reflects the commercial, the social, and the environmental context within which the organisation is operating. It's going to combine the most material elements of information that currently is being reported in very separate and disconnected ways, and will importantly show the connectivity between all of those elements and explain how they affect the ability of the organisation to create and sustain value. The main output that the IIRC anticipates is going to be a single report, a single external report that becomes the organisation's primary report, replacing all other existing requirements. And interestingly, South Africa has already moved to mandate integrated reporting, with the Johannesburg Stock Exchange already adopting standards that are going to require listed companies to produce their first iterations of integrated reports for the March 2012 reporting period. So, irrespective of what happens with the IIRC's reporting project, that project really just builds upon quite an extensive range of developments in financial and non-financial reporting. There's a very long list that includes things like the Global Reporting Initiatives. It's called the G3+1 Sustainability Reporting Guidelines. There's the Carbon Disclosure Project, the Prince of Wales Accounting for Sustainability Project, the Global Reporting Initiative, all of the reporting under the UN Global Compact. And here in Australia, we've got the Australian Water Accounting Standards Board set to issue in 2012 a final water accounting standard. And that standard already has legislative backing under the Water Act and also incorporates requirements for all general purpose water accounting reports to be independently assured for compliance with the water accounting standard. So these vast array of developments in non-financial reporting, I think, are reflective of two things. Firstly, that the information that's needed to assess past, current and future performance of organisations is much wider than is currently provided for by our existing financial reporting frameworks. And secondly, that there is an increasing number of organisations who actually get that this stuff is important, and that it's important to addressing it's important for them to be addressing sustainability because it does in fact make a positive contribution to their short and long-term value. So all of these waves of reform, I think, provide a tremendous opportunity for the audit profession. While the skill sets of the audit profession have historically been applied to providing assurance related to the preparation and presentation of financial statements, I think these skill sets need not be constrained to that application or to such a narrow application. And I think they are indeed capable of far broader application in providing assurance related to these far broader information sets. So my plea, I guess, back to the auditing profession is that it does need to organise itself, and it does need to develop and execute plans for directly capitalising on these opportunities and owning the external reporting space, assurance space, in the way that it currently owns financial reporting assurance. I think we have, as a profession, a window of opportunity to validly position ourselves as a critical element of market confidence, and I think that it's in this way that the audit profession can in fact rebuild the image of auditing as a stimulating and a rewarding career, and in fact position itself for a sustainable future. Thank you.
think you've touched on so many topics there that make us all realise that complacency is not the answer at the moment. I think there's been plenty of messages there for both practitioners and academics and those who are also involved in education, because I think this is all going to mean a lot of change over the coming years. So we now have some time for some questions. So anybody have a question? First hand that went up there, the microphone's heading towards you.
I'd like to ask Annette a question that's been exercising my mind for a bit about risk and cost, and that's the other part of outsourcing offshore, and that's companies outsourcing offshore their accounting, both global companies, their Australian operations, and Australian headquartered companies outsourcing or offshoring a lot of their accounting. Now, and it's been exercising my mind, what does that do to the risk from auditing from Australian perspective to Australian legal requirements and from a cost point of view? I take into account that you've said some things about your global database platform and what have you, but I'm interested to what you say the effect of that trend has been.
So I would draw a distinction between outsourcing and offshoring. I think they're two quite different things. And in some of the corporate community, we are seeing outsourcing of accounting and financial reporting tasks. I guess what I'm talking about, certainly for the firms, we're not outsourcing, we're absolutely offshoring. And the staff that are working in our global talent hubs, I can use Ernst & Young as an example, the staff that are working in our talent hubs in Philippines, Bangalore, the vast majority of them are actually UK-trained chartered accountants, Australian-trained CPAs and chartered accountants who have repatriated back to Philippines or even US-trained CPAs who are now back in India, in Philippines, who have undergone exactly the same learning and development and training programs that we have run for all of our staff around the world. By way of example, all of the senior managers in Ernst & Young, all their new senior managers, jumped on planes today to head to KL. All of our new senior managers right across the Asia Pacific region to do new senior manager training. It is exactly the same technical training across the globe. So we believe we've controlled for quality because we are, it's indifferent. Our people are trained in exactly the same way regardless of location. We've got a dedicated group of people on the ground in Philippines and in Bangalore who only work for the Australian firm. So the firms, we've contracted in well, 60,000 hours across those two sites, and that we're using staff who are absolutely trained in Australian auditing standards, accounting standards, most of whom are either British or Australian trained chartered accountants or CPAs as well. So I think the risk for us, we don't believe exists, and I think the best evidence of the risk mitigation or the risk elimination is that our clients are insisting that we use an offshoring model because they can see that it's going to drive cost savings as well. So in our own instance, our two biggest clients in Melbourne, the National Australia Bank, our two biggest audit clients, National Australia Bank and Telstra, have been incredibly supportive and proactive in encouraging us to do more of this in helping to maintain or minimise cost of providing assurance. Again, I think the corporates have been very good in managing and controlling for those risks as well, particularly if they are global organisations. So our clients, I'll use Siemens as an example, we do the global audit of Siemens. They do the similar sorts of things to what we do. They are training their staff around the globe in consistent ways and are able to use offshoring and in the same sort of way we are. So it's increasingly the audit clients of the major firms have global footprints and they are leveraging those global footprints to move work to low cost regions. So we're seeing our clients do the same sorts of things that we are and leverage their own global footprints to be able to do the same sorts of things.
Further questions?
Wondering about you've confined your comments really to external auditors. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering how, with the sort of amount of market failure we've had and the governance requirements, how you're seeing internal auditing change and how they're working together.
So, internal, it's a really interesting tale of it's two very different stories. Internal audit, I would say. Is expanding in scope. So internal audit, there's much more emphasis now, I think, on focusing on a broader array of risks. So thinking enterprise-wide risks, what are the key risks facing an organisation, and developing its internal audit program accordingly. So it's almost a cascading down approach. It's not constrained. Internal audit is no longer constrained to a focus on the economic side of things or the financial reporting side of things. So I think while we've seen internal audit really broaden its footprint, external audit is something quite different. What you will also find in the major firms, though, is quite a segregation of their assurance practices, of their audit practices. So our risk and internal audit practice for us now sits with our advisory practice, and I know the other firms are slightly different in their structure, but the common thing is that our internal audit and risk practices are quite separate to our, and run quite separately to our external audit practices. The other thing that's becoming really interesting around internal audit is the integration of risk specialists together with what I would call the performance improvement team. So as you do end-to-end reviews of processes, we're not only looking to see whether those processes are working as intended by having members of our advisory and consulting teams involved in these engagements, they're actually looking at those end-to-end processes and thinking about whether or not it's capable of doing it better, more efficiently, more effectively. So it's driving more value and insight would be the view that we're hearing back from a lot of our clients, that taking that sort of more holistic approach, incorporating performance improvement into the way we look at controls, end-to-end controls, is being really well received. But happening quite separate and in isolation to what's happening in the external audit space.
Okay. We had a question over okay. here. Keith.
Hi, Keith.
It's working.
It's working.
Annette, it's Keith Alfredson, a frustrated retired partner of an audit firm. I noticed one thing you did not mention at all during your talk was audit tendering. Mm-hmm. I can't help but thinking in my day the firms were their worst enemies. Put an audit out to tender, the immediate impact of the Big Five then was cut the fee, cost. We'll get the job then. Can you tell us how many public company audits, major public company audits, go out for tender, and what is the position of the audit fee after tender?
So, Keith, I have to confess to not having those numbers at hand, but you are dead right. The audit partner, with the changes brought about by CLRP 9, the requirements around audit partner rotation, we are seeing more and more corporates using that rotation as an opportunity to test the market. We particularly saw that through the GFC, and audit tenders were coming thick and fast. And I think I mentioned earlier on that in our desperate attempts to grab market share through the GFC, given that audit fees weren't growing and that we felt we needed to try and capture market share. My view is that the firms absolutely did end up competing on price. We all misguidedly and mistakenly believed if we did that, price would rebound at some point, and boy, were we wrong. But your observations are spot on, I think.
We have time for one more question.
Annette, arising from the global financial crisis and the debt crisis, what would you consider the single most important audit issue that was overlooked?
That was overlooked. Well, I think it's a good question. I think the most important issues related to, well, the two most important issues related to impairment and going concern assumption, they were the two biggies. I don't believe things were overlooked. I think the fact that we came through, I think the way that the audit profession came through the GFC is actually a testament to the fact that we didn't structurally fail, that audit withstood the stress test, if you like, of the GFC, but certainly the key areas, the really important and I guess the high risk issues were around the going, I'll add one more, it was the going concern assumption, it was impairment and probably debt classification, the current, non-current classification of debt was pretty high on the agenda as well. They were probably the three biggest issues that in every close monitoring panel that we that I was part of, that we convened, they were always on the agenda.
Okay, well, I'd like to now call on Joanne Rumble from the President of the Victorian Division of CPA Australia to present, to give us some closing remarks.
Can I sit
down? Yes, you can sit down if you wish.
Thank you very much, Professor Lyon. On behalf of CPA Australia and the University of Melbourne, I thank everyone for being here tonight. CPA Australia is delighted to once again join with the University of Melbourne in presenting this 72nd annual research lecture, the oldest continuous research lecture series to be held anywhere in the world. Since its origins in 1940, this lecture has proven to be an invaluable platform for the latest thinking and research in accounting and finance to be shared and discussed. At the heart of the relationship between CPA Australia and the University of Melbourne is the belief that education empowers people and helps them to realise their potential, ultimately leading to the advancement of the accounting profession as a whole. Tonight's lecture, and for several years now, has been delivered as part of CPA Australia's annual Congress here in Victoria. It is an important contribution to stimulate debate in emerging areas and to assist professionals to grapple with the new challenges, and the challenges abound, no doubt we've heard tonight. CPA Australia this year celebrates its 125th anniversary, and the history of CPA Australia is one of initiative, innovation, and change as markets, economies, and technologies change. But integrity and ethics remain constant, and it is the commitment to integrity and learning that lies at the root of the CPA Australia designation. And the designation is recognised and valued throughout the world, and CPA Australia delivers access to premium education, training, publication, and resources to all members, wherever they live, in whatever industry or sector they work in, and wherever they are in their professional career. The academic world is uniquely placed to take a leading role in this quest through its commitment to gaining ever deeper insights into these challenging topics, sharing that expertise with the wider profession, and informing on policy debates and regulatory direction. Annette has given us a fantastic speech tonight, and her experience and professionalism globally is recognised. And her thoughts around whether the auditing profession can evolve itself for a sustainable future has made for a compelling lecture here for us tonight. So, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of CPA Australia and the University of Melbourne, I'd like to thank Annette for her speech this evening and for your presentation. And I'd like to now invite Professor Maggie Abernathy to present Ms. Annette Kimmett with the University Medal. Over to you, Maggie.